Around Port-au-Prince, raging rivers and the threat of mudslides. Haitian authorities had tried to evacuate people from the most vulnerable areas. Now, as it churns north, Matthew is roughly the size of Arizona.
Yeah, this is not a drill, folks. It's devastating. It's Hurricane Matthew, and it's bearing down on the southeast U.S. coast, heading in the general direction of Florida next. Matthew, it's a Category 3 storm, about 115-mile-an-hour winds now, and it's going to come packing several feet of storm surge and waves maybe as high as 30 feet. Just in the last few hours, Matthew, which crossed eastern Cuba and was broken up a little bit, has redeveloped its eye on satellite. That's a sign it's getting stronger. And the latest tracks say Matthew will likely strafe Florida's pricey East Coast real estate with hurricane-force winds starting as soon as tomorrow. But there's still some big uncertainty on the precise forecast track. Could this be the big one for eastern Florida? I'm NPR News Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Let's fire up the Weather Lab.
The National Weather Service in Duluth, Minnesota has issued a tornado warning for...
Oh my God, it's a tornado!
A confirmed large and extremely dangerous tornado was located 4 miles...
Look at it did to the house across the way. All these houses are just torn up.
In chaos theory, the butterfly effect is the sensitive dependence on initial conditions.
Does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas?
Extreme weather events have increased in frequency over the last 50 years or so. They're expected to become even more common, more intense, and more costly.
We're either going to price your insurance at a huge markup, or we're not going to write it at all.
Well, it's been a nice long break for Florida and hurricanes. We knew this would probably happen eventually. If Matthew takes the track along the Florida coast, it could generate billion-dollar losses in eastern Florida. And then we're going to have to watch to see if it heads up to Georgia and the Carolinas potentially. Meteorologically speaking, for eastern Florida, that's kind of a worst-case scenario. The eye wall very close to the coast. Later Thursday into Friday. And this major hurricane track feeding off of extremely warm Gulf waters from the Atlantic and the Gulf Stream. The warm ocean still fueling and sustaining the hurricane as it tears along the east coast of Florida. Question is, are we about to witness a very costly weather disaster in the U.S. and in southeast and eastern Florida? And as always, we want to hear from you this hour. I want your questions or comments. 651-227-6000 if you're curious about Matthew or the track that it may take, or call us toll-free 800-242-2828 or jump online at nprnews.org/live. Weather underground hurricane expert Bob Henson, we've had him on before. He's here to break down the storm. We've also got Jenny Stiletovich. She covers the environment for the Miami Herald, and she joins us tonight from inside the forecast cone of uncertainty and hurricane warning zone in Miami. Jenny, good morning. You're in the warning zone, or close to it anyway. What's the message from public officials in Florida this morning?
Well, the message, I think, is very clear to prepare if you haven't already, because we're running out of time.
And what preps are underway right now? I know it's been 11 years since a serious hurricane event in eastern Florida. Is the public in serious storm prep mode?
I think they're starting to scramble. You know, we're South Florida here. We tend to take things a little, takes us a while to kind of pay attention. I know this morning I went to my local hardware store and they were out of batteries and flashlights already, and the supermarket was out of ice. So, and there were long lines at the gas station, but you don't really see a lot of people boarding up yet. I think here in South Florida, we're under just a tropical storm warning, which is severe, but you know, we tend to take that less seriously than a hurricane warning. I think as you look up the coast, you'll see people taking it a lot more seriously. I know Brevard County this morning, Brevard County had a mandatory evacuation for some of the barrier islands, but so far down here, there's no evacuations. The county mayor is having a press conference this morning to announce plans. You know, it's been a long time since we got hit by a major hurricane. So I think the bigger fear with authorities is that people don't really know what to expect because they don't remember. No, you know, Andrew was a long time ago.
Yeah, a lifetime for some folks. And you mentioned up the coast, and of course, the human impact of a hurricane is most important. But part of this going forward, that human impact, is the economic impact. And there's some pretty pricey real estate at risk as you head up toward Palm Beach and points north. You know, how much valuable real estate is along that coast as you head north of Miami?
I don't know a dollar amount. I know Palm Beach, as everybody knows, a barrier island that's got some really pricey real estate on it. Further north, Vero Beach. You can just kind of every coastal community, right? In Florida now has gotten pretty pricey.
Yeah, Bob Hansen, thanks for being with us this morning. Let's break down some of the meteorology of Hurricane Matthew: wind, storm surge, waves, rainfall, all threats. Looking at the track as we focus first on eastern Florida, I think one important point to make is this is sort of a razor's edge. If the latest tracks keep the eye just offshore or just brushing the shore, any little variance to the left, to the west, or to the right could have a huge difference in the conditions on the coast, won't it?
That is absolutely true. This is really one of those cases where the geography of the coastline and how it intersects with the hurricane track makes a huge difference. I mean, we've got a hurricane coming in essentially from the southeast moving northwest, and that's exactly the orientation of the Florida coast once you get north of about Palm Beach. So you overlay those tracks on each other, and they're almost like mirror images. So if you push things 50 miles to the west and you have a hurricane coming on shore 50 miles to the east, the whole thing stays offshore. And those are pretty small amounts of margins of error when you're talking about something 2 or 3 days out. So this is going to be a tough one. It means preparing for the worst, but maybe not getting the worst, but you simply have to prepare because of that possibility.
Let's talk about Matthew right now. I noticed it crossed eastern Cuba overnight, seemed to mess with the circulation a little bit. The eye is back on satellite images now, and it's moving over some pretty warm water in the Bahamas. That should be favorable for strengthening. Does that fit with what you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. This is kind of a subjective thing, but Matthew seems to be one of these hurricanes that simply bounces back and performs better than you think it will. I mean, it was much stronger in the Caribbean than people thought, given the wind shear going on there. And now it's moving into the Bahamas with not too much wind shear. It's actually arguably better conditions than it had in the Caribbean. So in some ways, it'll really have a good shot to intensify. It's right now a minimal Cat 3. I wouldn't be surprised if it bounced back up to high Cat 3, maybe even in the Cat 4 range by tomorrow. It has 2 full days before it will be approaching the Florida coast.
Jenny, I know Floridians are pretty hurricane aware, you would think so, but it's been a long time since you've had sort of a major hit there. Do you think that folks are really tuned into those fluctuations in track and intensity with Matthew?
I actually do think people pay attention to the track. The internet has made access to that available to everybody, so you can literally watch it flip-flop back and forth. And in some ways, that might be a danger because people look at track to track instead of looking, at the trends. That's what meteorologists always tell me is
right.
Pay attention to each, track. Look at the trend. So I know when I talk to people, they kind of go back and forth, and I have to remind them to just look at the trend.
Well, not only that, but with the explosion of social media, and there's a lot of weather geeks out there. I say this sometimes: everyone thinks they're a meteorologist now, and it's good to kind of stick with the Hurricane Center when in doubt. They're the best on the planet. So now, Jenny, I know you have to run to a briefing. If you can, tell us real quickly where you're headed here in the next hour.
Well, I'm just looking out for that 11 a.m. advisory, which is the next full advisory, or I think it's a full advisory from the National Hurricane Center.
Yeah, sure. And you're writing for this, for the Herald. What's your angles that you're looking at?
So far, I'm just trying to track the storm and put out the information as best I can, and then sort of incorporate in that all the preparations that are being done down here.
All right. Well, good luck, and we hope for Miami's sake anyway, the current track holds and it mostly slides to the northeast of you. But have a good luck with the storm as it rides by.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jenny. And Bob, back to the hurricane this morning. The gusts that we look at around a hurricane, this is another important point. Everybody focuses on the eye, right? But even we could get gusts. I looked at some of the guidance to 75 to 100 miles an hour along a pretty good stretch of the east coast of Florida. Important to note that it's not just near the eyewall where you can see hurricane conditions, right?
That's absolutely correct. With a hurricane like this, you're going to have an area probably maybe 50 miles outside the center that could have hurricane force winds. Now, those will be a little more concentrated and stronger on the east side, so that's one good thing, that it'll mostly be the west side of Matthew along, you know, onto the coast if the track holds and it's just on the coast or just off the coast. But you're talking about an area with millions and millions of people getting essentially hurricane force winds, and that would definitely be enough to bring trees down, power lines down. It really caused all kinds of havoc, and I can easily see this being, you know, a multi-billion-dollar hurricane if it kind of slogs and crunches its way up the coast and doesn't slam in and cause really catastrophic damage at any one point, but it causes, you know, substantial damage over a large area. And it could yet make landfall. You know, I'm not dismissing the notion that it could simply move in at some point, but right now the best guidance is that it's going to essentially slide up the coast. For people who might remember, Hurricane David did this back in 1979, which is an eternity ago when it comes to social media and people's memories, but it did do that, and it wasn't as strong as Matthew will likely be, so that's something to keep in mind.
651-227-6000, if you have questions for myself or Bob Hansen from the Weather Underground this morning. 800-242-2828, toll-free is the number to call. We're talking hurricanes, specifically Matthew, as it makes a beeline into the Bahamas today and then generally heads toward the east coast of Florida. And Bob, the tracks have been, you know, we talk about uncertainty, right, with hurricane forecasting, especially 2, 3, 4, 5 days out. This thing has, I would say, given us a greater degree of uncertainty with the tracks. We're starting to see some of the models now even forecast a loop that this goes up the east coast of Florida toward Georgia and then loops to the right. A couple of them even brought it back into Florida briefly. Talk a little bit about the uncertainty with this system and why that's happening.
You know, the looping is enough to make you tear your hair out. And I was corresponding with my co-blogger, Dr. Jeff Masters, this morning, and he's been watching these for 35 years as a tropical meteorologist, and he's beside himself. This is so crazy. It's not unheard of to have a large loop. In fact, Hurricane Ivan did just that. It had 2 U.S. landfalls because of that loop. So it would not be unheard of, but boy, to have both of those on the east coast of Florida would be really something. And there is gradually increasing model support for this idea that next week there could be, Matthew, something, you know, on the order of perhaps hurricane strength heading back. But that's way, way, way into the future. We've got the first landfall to worry about. And that forecast has been tricky as well. I mean, there's been little doubt that Matthew would come up toward the southeast coast. But the model struggled for a couple of days in whether Florida would be at much risk. And it turns out the ridge to the north of Matthew turned out to be just strong enough to push it westward, essentially. And that's why we're getting this track kind of paralleling the coast on Friday and probably Saturday, parts of Saturday.
Well, Bob, if 2 weather geeks is good, 3 has to be better. So I've got Jeffrey Halverson here. He's a severe storms expert with the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He contributes to the Washington Post Capital Weather Gang. And, of course, we've had Capital Weather Gang folks on the show before as well. Jeffrey, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yo, you're welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. I assume you've been listening a little bit. Do you have any comments right off the top in terms of Matthew and what you've been seeing?
Well, this has been a very, very frustrating forecast for the past several days. And, you know, several important points have been made by the guests on the show already. I will say that we have the benefit of these fairly medium-range forecast models, which have gotten better and better and better over the years, that take us out 7, 8, 9, 10 days now with predictions of where these storms might head, how strong they might be, how large they might be. And it's become almost like a double-edged sword for those of us who are meteorologists. Like Bob said, anyone could be a meteorologist by simply looking at the models. But unfortunately, what people do is that they tend to see a very harrowing-looking forecast prediction for a storm 8, 9, 10 days out. They're quick to throw it on social media. They want to get as many hits as they can on Facebook and be liked. And it turns turns out that it forces us meteorologists to go into an early mode of what I call damage control. Mm-hmm. Most meteorologists would keep this stuff very close to the chest because the error at 8, 9, 10 days is often tremendous. And so when it ends up happening is I think the public just gets confused because they see the back and forth of these models. And I think it partially undermines the efforts of us trying to advance the science in the public's eye.
Well, agreed. And we have those discussions at conferences, I know, all the time between meteorologists. What's the right amount of information, and how soon do we give that? Very interesting discussion on that. Bob Hansen, Matthew's presented several problems. It's also been sort of a unique hurricane. It set some early records in terms of intensity in the Caribbean. Why is Matthew unique so far?
I think one of the most unique parts about Matthew is how strong it is, especially as a potential U.S. threat so late in the year. We do get October hurricanes fairly frequently, but they tend to be in the Gulf Coast. Florida has had a number of strikes on the west coast of Florida during October, but there are very, very few analogs for a substantial hurricane coming into Florida from the east. In fact, I don't believe there's been any major hurricane landfalls on the east coast of Florida in October, with the exception of Hurricane King, all the way back in 1950, which came up through Miami from the south-southeast. So the lateness of this hurricane is certainly noteworthy. I would say the resilience, how it's managed to fight off wind shear and be about as strong as the hurricane could be over the waters it's been over. So those things are unique, and certainly these waters in the Bahamas, the Caribbean, are close to record levels for this time of year, and that jibes with the record warm year we're having globally and certainly regionally. So those are all factors that we have to take into account.
Jeffrey, the models, we talked about the uncertainty with this. They had a late westward shift in the track that's brought it much closer to the U.S. How do you think they did so far? And, of course, do we really know yet? We don't know yet, do we?
I think the models are kind of par for the course. Unfortunately, when you get out past 5-6 days, you tend to see this windshield wipering in the models. Each run 6-12 hours is going to have these fairly large shifts left and right, and it's very unnerving, but you kind of get used to seeing this behavior. And it's also another reason why you've got to be very, very careful in how you interpret these models so many days before the actual event. We've got the European model, the American model, those are the two flagship models everyone talks about. But the other thing I want to tell listeners is that there is something called ensemble forecasting, mm-hmm. where you change the initial conditions just very slightly each time you run these models. And the idea behind that is there's always a little bit of error in the observations and how you bring those observations into the models. And what those ensembles do is that they generate 20, 25, 30 different possible outcomes based on slight tweakings of the initial conditions. And that gives you kind of a range of the uncertainty. And that's actually the better set of products to be looking at beyond 5 or 6 days. And I think the ensembles, are a very powerful tool. We're seeing those used more and more. The whole idea is about reducing the uncertainty and conveying that to the public and to decision makers and policy makers. You see a lot more emphasis on how can we bracket this uncertainty for people beyond 5, 6, 7 days.
Well, and that goes to communication, which is, I've always said, every bit as important as the forecast. How we communicate in meteorology and broadcast meteorology specifically, critical. Bob, what do you think about Jeffrey's comments about ensembles in general and the communication of hurricane threats?
I completely support what Jeff was saying about ensembles. They're a hugely helpful tool. I do think in terms of public communication, they can be a challenge because not only do you have, say, one model's ensemble, which has itself maybe 20, even to as many as 50 members, but then you have multiple models, each with their own ensembles. And then each of those ensembles is being produced every 12 hours, sometimes every 6 hours. So you end up with a huge number of potential maps. And again, as Jeff alluded to, anyone who has the background can throw these maps onto the internet without context and really throw people into a tizzy. So the ensembles are a hugely helpful tool, and they as long as they're interpreted correctly. And really, it's so important to just look at the trends in multiple runs, multiple ensembles, and not fixate on one model solution. But where is the pack headed? How widely dispersed is the pack? That tells you how much actual uncertainty there is with this particular storm. I would like to point out, just so people are clear on it, that the cone that people see that is produced by the National Hurricane Center is the average error at each point in time for the last 5 years. In other words, the width of the cone at 120 hours is the average error within which about two-thirds of hurricanes fall over the past 5 years. So it's not a specific depiction of the amount of uncertainty with this hurricane. It's what we've seen over the last 5 years with all hurricanes. And some hurricanes are going to have a little more uncertainty, and some will have a little less. But the best thing is to go with the NHC cone, because over time, over the last 5 years, that's been the uncertainty. And that's why the cone is such a valuable
thing. And we call it, of course, the cone of uncertainty, which is kind of an interesting phrase all in and of itself. Let's talk about the changes in the track with Matthew and what that means for people that have to plan, civil emergency managers along the coast. I think it's safe to say there's hurricane warnings up for the east coast of Florida, but we still can't give a specific impact, I think, yet in terms of Matthew along the east coast. That track paralleling the coast, one of the most difficult, I think, because a shift either way and you've got maybe tropical storm force winds versus the eyewall raking the coast. Jeffrey, how do emergency managers approach this information that they're getting from experts like the Hurricane Center?
Yeah, well, you know, this is the type of thing that I think gets to psychology of risk perception and how individuals perceive hazards, and that, unfortunately, varies tremendously from person to person. I think an emergency manager, to be responsible, has got to heed the official advice, and that's being provided by National Hurricane Center and National Weather Service. You have to plan for the worst and essentially hope for the best. You can't risk such a powerful storm, a Cat 3, with the potential for great loss of life and devastation when it's that close to your neighborhood, that close to your backyard. And as Bob discussed, 50-mile, 60-mile shift of that track either way could be absolutely critical. And so all that has to be taken into account. You know, emergency planners walk a tightrope. They are in a balancing act because you often hear the off-quote statistics, well, it's about $1 million or so to evacuate every mile of coastline. So there's huge economic potential losses tied to these mass evacuations, to shutting down communities, to boarding them up, to basically calling off business for 2 or 3 days. However, do you risk that, and you have to balance that with the potential for loss of life, and that's the mission of NOAA Hurricane Center, is protection of life foremost, okay? And so it's very, very difficult, balancing act to walk, and you also have to be very careful because there is a tendency to overwarn for these storms out of necessity because of the error inherent in the cone. And overwarning often breeds what we call cry-wolf syndrome. So a lot of the folks within that cone are not going to experience hurricane force conditions in all likelihood. This is the case for just about any hurricane.
Right.
But that does is erode confidence. The next time you got to put out these warnings, people remember, oh, well, the last time, wasn't quite so bad. We didn't really get hit. It's probably just going to be the same routine this time.
And we call that siren fatigue in tornado country. I mean, it's the same general phenomenon.
Warning fatigue.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, when Sandy hit New York and New Jersey 2012, the previous year's storm, Irene, was not as bad as forecast. And I think that undermined the credibility of Sandy's forecast. And so this problem keeps replaying itself year after year.
Bob, I know jump in there, please.
Yes, the same thing I'm a little concerned about with the fact that Hurricane Hermine was such a no-show over the Northeast, even though there were tropical storm watches and such over a large part of the New York and related area. It was actually pretty nice weather for part of that period. So I'm afraid, people will think this is like Hermine, and it's not. It's a much more serious threat.
Bob, I know you said you might have to run out. You're welcome to stay with us if you want, but I want to bring somebody else in who may be able to shed some light. Jeffrey, you mentioned risk. You mentioned economic losses. And that's something that I know the insurance industry is watching. There's millions of people watching the path, but the insurance industry has a keen and a financial interest. So we've got Andrew Sifford. He's with the Twin Cities-based BMS Intermediaries. They're a reinsurance group that has significant interest in the possible catastrophic losses from Matthew. Andrew, good morning.
Morning, Paul. Thanks for having me back on the show.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you again. Threats to life, threats to property, both, of course, can happen. This has serious potential to be a significant, potentially what, catastrophic loss scenario for Eastern Florida, right?
Yeah, I mean, going through some of the basic scenarios, even some of the historical analog events, such as that David 1979 event, some of those are producing some pretty large financial losses, not just economically, but to the insurance industry itself.
Well, can you quantify that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to. So when you think, so the insurance industry, we use catastrophic models to help us understand losses. And these are basically computer-assisted calculations of estimating loss to an individual property or a group of properties due to, you know, wind speed and storm surge,
mm-hmm.
or even earthquake in that realm.
And are those storm-specific? Is that something you can model for Matthew?
Yep. So basically, I mean, it's really hard. There's no exact simulation that will provide the exact track for Matthew. As you know, there's definitely uncertainties right now where that storm will track along the Florida coastline, but the insurance industry, you know, and actually for about a good week now, has been running several scenarios in these catastrophe models, or even just looking at historical analog events to get an idea of what type of damage might occur along that path.
And do we have any numbers that you can share?
Well, I mean, just kind of going back and touching on some of the historical events that somewhat match the current track of Matthew. I mean, they're not going to be exact, but you can take, like, Hurricane Floyd in 1999. Now, Floyd passed pretty far from the Florida coastline and roughly caused about $50 million of insured loss to Florida as it just bypassed. It didn't even impact, you know, it didn't make landfall in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Another storm that's been referenced already is that Hurricane David in 1979 that basically skirted the Florida coastline and moved up into Georgia. Now, if you were to take that storm and put it over the exposure of the eastern U.S., which has grown substantially in the last decade, it comes out to be, you know, about $1.6 billion of just insurance industry loss. Now, keep in mind, David was a much weaker storm than what Matthew is being forecasted at, so that 1.6 is a pretty solid estimate on maybe a certain scenario that you would expect from Matthew if it were to track that close to the U.S. coastline of Florida.
Bob, I know Weather Underground keeps track of billion-dollar weather disasters every year, and Andrew makes a good point. The value of real estate has skyrocketed since a lot of these historical analogs. Does that make sense to you that $1.6 billion is an easy number potentially if it follows the current forecast track?
I think that's a really safe bet. I'm really glad to hear that in terms of it's consistent with the kind of intuitive impression I had thinking of David versus Matthew, you know, Matthew being stronger and so much more value and property and stuff along the coast. And especially given the kind of scraping track we have, you know, it's the latest cone is just out and we have Matthew, just east of Jacksonville, Florida, at 2 a.m. Saturday, heading east from northeast from there. So it may not get as close to the Outer Banks as we thought. The CONUS is edging a little bit east and southeast with every run. So maybe the Carolinas will be spared from a direct hit, although we can still expect a lot of rain up there. And that's one thing we haven't talked about, you know, the heavy rain risk, especially if it makes it that far north. The Eastern Carolinas have had 10 to 15 inches of rain over the last 2 or 3 weeks, and flooding is one of the big risks with a large, sprawling hurricanes like this one. So, I would not be at all surprised to see this be a multi-billion-dollar hurricane.
And, Jeffrey, I'm looking at that 11 a.m. update that Bob talked about. It has Matthew has a major hurricane very close to the Space Coast, 8 a.m. Friday, you know, with the eye wall perhaps very close to onshore, if not onshore. What are your thoughts on that going forward?
Yeah, and it's all going to come down to just the slightest shift in track when it's that close. There is such a difference in wind speed, sustained wind, on either side of the eye. It's astounding how much variation there can be with, obviously, the weaker quadrant being the western semicircle, the strong quadrant being the eastern semicircle. You can have differences of 50, 60, 70 miles an hour across just a small distance on the order of 50, 60, 70 miles. And Andrew really brought that point home when it struck South Florida in 1992. Andrew was a very, very compact, one of the most compact vortices ever to hit the United States as a Cat 5. And there the gradient in damage was astounding, even from neighborhood to neighborhood. So I would say this is really, really being on a knife edge with a Cat 3 sitting just outside, you know, a major, major, scientific industrial complex, the spaceport of NASA. That's very harrowing.
Andrew, we've got less than a minute left, but I want to get a little insight into your business. When a hurricane causes a major catastrophic loss, and they add up in general, how does that affect all of our insurance rates overall eventually? How is that factored into the pool of risk?
Yeah, that's a great question, Paul. I mean, really, it kind of depends. I mean, how large the event's going to be. I mean, overall insurance is a pool of risk across the U.S. for the most case. So hopefully that risk is diversified. So one loss from maybe a hurricane or a hailstorm in the Midwest isn't going to impact an insurance company too greatly. And thankfully, you know, we have gone 10 years without a major hurricane loss for the insurance industry. In terms of a major hurricane making landfall, that is. So it's been quite a while. So, I mean, insurance companies are fairly ready to equip, but not to say that, you know, this can potentially change rates. It really depends on what type of loss is going to occur from Matthew here in the next few days.
All right. Thanks, you guys. Bob Henson, Jeffrey Halverson, Andrew Sifford. Great discussion. Now we watch and wait the precise track. We'll keep an eye on it the next couple of days. Tom Weber's up next.